So I want to start out this morning with a verse that may, in a few words, summarize the problem with the revivals and the Great Awakening that we've been studying. And that verse is 1 Corinthians 14:40. Anyone know that by memory? It concerns when we gather together for worship, and it says this: but all things should be done decently and in order. Have you heard that before? If anything does not describe these awakening meetings, when people were yelling and screaming and there was no church oversight of any of these men. By the way, if you're reading the news, have we seen the damage done by celebrity pastors with no oversight? So what we're going to talk about today is the aftermath of the revivals. And it's interesting that historians have noted that many of the world's great cults, great as in large, as well as new strange teachings, all came from the same place and time. And that is from America in the early 1800s and mid-1800s. And that was the time of the revivals, where you had people who were throwing away the past, throwing away doctrine from the past, rejecting what the church has already put together in her confessions, and wanted something new. Everyone wanted something new. The revivals were new. So when you want something new and exciting, you set yourself up for very strange and bad teachings. And so we're going to go over a few of them this morning. The first one is dispensationalism. It's no accident that dispensationalism gained a foothold in the aftermath of the revivals. John Darby came over to America just as people were burning out from the revivals, and now they wanted something new. And so what did Darby offer? A whole new view of the Bible that no one's ever heard before. Now, I did a class probably September on dispensationalism, so we're not going to do it here. You can go to the archives online of Sunday School if you want that in detail. But what I want to point out that dispensationalism became the most prominent teaching in America, but the soil for that new teaching was the revivalistic mentality. It was right after everyone had experienced this that they were ripe for all these new teachings, because none of these men who were going around preaching taught sound doctrine, and there was no oversight from the churches to disciple and explain the scriptures. And so it opened up to all these things that we have with us today. So you have dispensationalism. The second movement that arose is Mormonism. Mormonism arose in Upper New York State. Now, what did we say last week about Upper New York State? What was it called? Well, it was, but there was a certain term we used after the revivals, the burned over or burned out district. They had so many revivals that they were burnt out and didn't want those anymore, and they were ripe for something new. So you have something starting right after the revivals that, as you know, now there's over 15 million worldwide, over 60,000 full-time missionaries, $30 billion in assets with over $6 billion a year gross income. By the way, the Sports Authority right behind us was bought by the Mormon Church, this building. I talked to the guy Friday night who actually brokered that contract, and he says he's not sure if they're going to turn that into a Mormon church or just going to use it as an asset. But if they do, it's going to be good for us because they always do things very nice. So the founder was Joseph Smith, born 1805, and many of you know this story, so I'll just run through it quickly. Born in Vermont, parents were religious, but not affiliated with any church. Now that sounds like the revivals, right? They didn't care about church membership or affiliation, as long as you were religious. His parents ventured into capitalism. This is important for the background of Mormonism. They lost everything. Some say it was their own fault. Others say they were cheated by big city lawyers. And that idea will play a prominent role in Joseph Smith. They moved to Palm Run, New York in 1816. Smith was known as a con man. He was convicted by swindling people. He convinced them that he could find buried treasure by using seer stones, magic stones. So Smith wrote two separate accounts of what happened to him in the wilderness that day in the woods in western New York. I'll give you the official Mormon version. After attending a revival, note the importance there, after attending a Christian, quote unquote, revival that we've been talking about, Joseph, a teenager, prayed to God to show him the true church so he could join it. He went to the woods and he said he was visited by two heavenly beings, God the Father and God the Son. They instruct him not to join any church because they're all false, and that God would show him the true church and he would be a prophet of that true church. He claimed to receive another vision from an angel named Moroni. He said this angel told him of an ancient tribe of Israel, the Nephites, that lived in America years before, and that they would be then the descendants of that ancient Israel tribe. So Mormons would be the last tribe of Israel, of God's people. Their history was recorded on sacred golden tablets that had been buried in the woods near where he lived since the 4th century. 4 years later, Smith claimed that angel gave him these tablets, and they were written in ancient Egyptian. I have no idea how, if it's in America, why it would be written in Egyptian. But anyway, Smith claimed to use seeing stones to receive the translation of these tablets from God. He claimed he would put them in his hat, he'd stuck his face in the hat, and the translation of the tablets would simply magically appear. Then he would have it written down, and he was claimed to be told that he wasn't to show anyone. Eventually, that translation from these magic stones were published as the Book of Mormon in 1830. Smith and his brother were later arrested for being con men and awaiting trial. A mob broke into the prison and killed Smith and his brother. That probably did more to help Mormonism grow, because now Smith was a martyr. He had been killed for the cause. So the Mormons were heavenly persecuted and they were forced to flee from New York. Mormonism was a poor man's religion. Remember we talked about last week, one of the themes of the revivals was against professionalism in America, whether clergy, lawyers, doctors. We can do it ourselves. We don't need their authority, their wisdom. Who are they to tell us? And so this was a religion for poor people against the rich, which is sort of ironic, right? Because what are Mormons known for today? They're money. But at that time, it was a religion for poor people. One of the themes of the Book of Mormon was God's plan to give America to the poor, that the rich would be judged and the poor would inherit the earth. And those poor were the Mormons back then. As you know, they moved west. Eventually, they settled in Utah. Smith began teaching new things like polygamy. Smith had about 30 wives. Smith was very handsome. Now, the official Mormon portraits make him look like a Greek god. I don't think he was quite that handsome. But he was very handsome and drew a number of women to himself, and some he married very young. Most of them were over 18. Smith also taught polytheism, that each planet has its own god over the planet, and each of those gods were once humans. And so he wrote, this is quoting him, "God himself was once as we are now an exalted man, and sits enthroned in yonder heavens. God himself, the Father of us all, dwelt on an earth, the same as Jesus Christ himself did. So in Mormonism, if you're a good Mormon and you're male, you can become a god of another planet like the god of this planet. So after you die, you will be in charge. The wife won't be in charge. She'll be sort of your helper wife. But as a man, you will become a god over another planet. Now, you can stop here and say, magic stones, Egyptian tablets, a 4th century Jewish tribe in America, 30 wives. Why would anyone buy this? How did this turn into a cult that is now this many people? How did that start in America? Why were so many people open to this? That's rhetorical, because we've already answered the question. Some other strange teachings of the Mormon Church, racism. Non-white people were considered under a curse, especially the black race was considered the curse of Cain in Genesis 9. And so until the late 70s, that's the 1970s, African Americans were excluded from temple priesthood. They could not be priests. They could not go through the temple ceremony. The prophet in the 70s, under pressure, received a new revelation from God that had changed. I guess God grew up. So in the book, in Mormonism, there are three modes of revelation. There are the three, there's the Book of Mormon and the two other supplemental books. There's the Bible, which they believe is inspired, and the head prophet of the Mormon Church. So after Joseph Smith, Brigham Young was the next prophet. Of course, you've heard of BYU. And then they would vote and elect in successive prophets who can receive any new revelation. So anything can change if the prophet declares something from God. You can turn the page. A few other beliefs of Mormonism. Dominion theology. This is the idea that if you're a Mormon, God will eventually judge America and Mormons will be given the country. They will have dominion. That's why all Mormons keep a very large amount of food stored. How many of you are familiar with this? All Mormon families have a large amount of food stored when God will do something drastic to the country. And during that time, you're going to need a lot of food, and then the Mormons will take over in dominion. No clergy. There's no official clergy in the Mormon Church. The forced tithing, if you're a Mormon, you need to give 10%. You will be asked for your salary. And if you don't give 10%, you will be visited by someone from the Mormon Church. Secrecy, obviously they're known for their secrecy. They're not allowed to explain what goes on in the temple. Yeah, how many of you have seen a Mormon temple before? Have any of you seen the one in outside San Diego in La Jolla? It looks, it's scary looking. Isn't there one around here, like a huge temple? Okay. That's a smaller one, yeah. And you'll know, yeah, you should see the big ones, like in La Jolla. In Salt Lake, yes. Undergarments, there are undergarments once you're in the temple and you become a priest. There are special undergarments you wear all your life that ward off evil and protect you, that have symbols on them. It is salvation by works. To go to heaven, you must be a good Mormon. Originally, when Joseph Smith taught, all Christian denominations were called Babylon. That's actually in their writings. So they are the only true people of God. Over time, because they've wanted to be accepted as evangelicals, they've softened that. But that's actually what officially the Mormon Church teaches, that Christians are Babylon. They are under God's judgment. Other things, you know, no alcohol, no caffeine, no fun. I added that. required missions. You know, the young people have to go on a 2-year mission. And during those 2 years, they are separated from their family. They are, I'm told, the only times they can call their family, it's monitored. It's not like you think where they can get on Skype and talk to their families every night. And obviously, they push strong families. If you go to a local Mormon gathering on a Sunday, you won't hear about the things Joseph Smith taught doctrinally. You'll hear about strong families, being good husbands and wives, and being good citizens. You know, very safe and moral. But you have to get really involved to hear what Joseph Smith actually taught. It was a distinctly American phenomena. It was based on God setting apart America as something special. Now, that's not new to Mormonism, is it? We've been seeing that in what has already been established. But they took it in a very strange direction, didn't they? Any other thoughts or questions on Mormonism? Yes. They live with contradictions because they're taught not to question much and simply accept by faith what they're taught. When I was a youth pastor in Southern California, in our town, which you heard of Temecula? In our town, the Mormon church wanted to be accepted as one of the evangelical churches. And I was the youth pastor of the largest church in Temecula at that time. It was a community church. So he asked if we could do something together. And this was the bishop of all what's called North County, which is San Diego. I said, I'll tell you what, let's do this. Let's have a discussion in front of both of our youth groups. And I will simply ask you what you believe, but I won't comment. And I won't debate you. I'll simply ask you and you answer. So the kids could learn what Mormonism is. So he's like, okay, you're not going to. And I said, I won't even read anti-Mormon literature. I'll just use your literature and I'll ask you questions. So he agreed to that. So going back to Simon's questions, one of the questions, because they believe the Bible, I said, now the Mormon church teaches that caffeine is sinful, but Jesus taught that anything going into you is clean. And I quoted Mark, is it Mark 7? So if you believe the Mormon church and the Bible, how do you harmonize those? And he started getting really nervous and uncomfortable, and we just trust the prophet. And so I kept doing that, and he was getting angrier and angrier. And he actually, there's a thing Mormons do where they bear testimony. Are you familiar with that? They have a prepared statement when they're being challenged. And they say, I swear by this, I bear testimony. And then he walked out, and all his youth group walked out with him. The point is, they couldn't handle discrepancies, and so they don't deal with it. Anything else concerning Mormonism? Most of you are familiar with Mormonism. I wanted you to be familiar of the connection with the revivals that were going on. Yes?
Well, it's interesting how little, like you were saying, modern-day Mormons really don't know about Joseph Smith and his writing. So he had 3 different revisions of his translation.
Yes. Yes.
I'm just curious, do you know if Mormons have, like, they must have their own seminary and their own?
I mean, they have local, what they call seminary, where they teach young people, and they usually go before school starts. And they have BYU, where they teach theology. Any other questions on Mormonism? It's really tough to witness to a Mormon because their religion is based on fear. There's just a lot of fear to question. And so you really have to pray God will open them up to even be willing to consider anything. because they're taught that even questioning is lack of faith and dangerous. Yes?
What do you mean by no clergy?
They don't have any official paid clergy in the Mormon church. They'll have bishops, but they're just volunteers from the congregation. And they're not trained or anything, just whoever. I mean, you can support someone politically, but you're right. He was sort of an accepting of, well, he's a Christian like us.
Yeah.
Like, no. Any other thoughts? Well, let's go to the next one. You're probably not familiar with this one, and it's not Carl's fault. It's Millerism. Millerism, at the time, was actually more popular than Mormonism. But Millerism, for an obvious reason we'll get to, died, where Mormonism picked up steam over the years. Millerism was founded by William Miller, born in Massachusetts in 1782. He served as a captain in the War of 1812 at the Battle of Plattsburgh. The American forces were very much outnumbered, and yet they still defeated the British. And so Miller was convinced God had a special plan for America. South Mayor. Miller and his family moved to Loehampton in the burnt-over district of New York. Here we go again. He became a Baptist. He began an intense study of the Bible to debate his deist friends. We talked about deism earlier. He became fascinated with prophecy, Daniel and Revelation. He was convinced that he had read the Daniel and Revelation to the point that he knew when Christ was coming back. He knew the year Christ was coming back. So he announced Christ would return in 1843. In 1831, he presented his conclusions in public lectures, and people stacked the audience. They were fascinated. They wanted to hear more. They thought he was right. Now, what set the stage for that? Here we go again, right? He presented his conclusions to some local Baptist papers. And in 1840, a Boston pastor named Joshua Vaughn Himes was convinced that Miller was correct. So he started a biweekly paper called Signs of the Times, where he would publish Miller's teachings. He had almost 50,000 followers nationwide soon. Millions of tracts and pamphlets were being circulated with Miller's findings. He claimed the second coming would then come not only the year, but the day, March 21st, 1843. Between March 21st and March 21st, 1844, so that year. Now, after that first March passed, the chronology was revised to April 3rd. Then when the Lord didn't come April 3rd, he said April 18th. Doesn't that sound like what's his name in San Antonio, the Blood Moon guy? Yeah, Hagee's always revising when the... So, on April 18th, thousands of Millerites around the country would prepare, and in Boston, on the 18th, many of them gathered into the temple, the Advent temple. Now, obviously, they were all disappointed. After that date, Miller wrote to the faithful, "I confess my error and acknowledge my disappointment, yet I still believe that the day of the Lord is near, even at the door." These guys don't give up, do they? Now, here's an example of some of what happened as a result of people waiting. In 1844, Millerite follower Samuel Snow presented a final revision of the chronology. He fixed the date to October 22nd. He said, "Miller was close, but I've read Daniel, and he was off some months." Now, on October 22nd, once that got around the country, people all over the country quit their jobs. They sold their possessions. They gathered, and they waited for Christ to return. Some in churches, some on hilltops. And that day in history became known as the Great Disappointment. For obvious reasons. So you've got the great awakening, and now you've got the great disappointment. We have some of the, right now, it's interesting that the amount of people who are in psych wards the next day grew. We have records, because people were so convinced, and then they didn't know what happened. So here are some writings from those people. Henry Evans wrote, "I waited all Tuesday, and dear Jesus did not come. After 12 o'clock, I began to feel faint, and before dark, I needed someone to help me up to my chamber, as my natural strength was leaving me very fast, and I lay prostrate for 2 days without any pain, sick with disappointment." Hiram Edson wrote, "Our fondest hopes and expectations were blasted, and loss of all earthly friends could have been no comparison. And such a spirit of weeping came over us as I never experienced before. It seemed that the loss of all earthly friends could have been no comparison. We wept and wept till the day dawned. I mused in my own heart, saying, my Advent experience has been the richest and brightest of all my Christian experience. If this had proved a failure, what was the rest of my Christian experience worth? Has the Bible proved a failure? Is there no God, no heaven, no golden home city, no paradise? Is all this but a cunningly devised fable? Is there no reality to our fondest hope and expectation of these things? Do you think there's serious consequences to a lack of sound theology? He's ready to give up on God, isn't he? Now, we have dispensationalism, we have Mormonism, and we have Millerism all arising from the ashes of the Great Revival. But that's not all. There were some offshoots of Millerism. Some of them were convinced that Miller was still right, that Christ actually returned, but he returned invisibly. And he shut the door of salvation to most people that day. They did not give up on Miller's findings. Now, Hiram Edson's group, I just read from him, who said Jesus must have returned invisibly, started his own church called the Seventh-day Adventists. You've heard of them. Now they have 15 million members. Strange teachings coming out of the revivals. The Adventists claim that in 1844, Jesus did come, but he entered his heavenly sanctuary to do final activity on the earth. So 1844 is an official day in Seventh-day Adventist, official year in Seventh-day Adventist theology from the Millerite teaching. Another Millerite, and now we go on, Charles Russell formed a group called the Jehovah's Witnesses. Have you heard of the Jehovah's Witnesses? Now think of that. All these world's most well-known cults all started in the same country, at the same time, in the same area. Do you think that's a coincidence? So I am arguing that we follow the Bible in evangelism, in theology, and how we do church, and not rejecting our forefathers from the past as if we're smarter than all them and we don't need their formulations and what they've taught us. All right, that was all me talking. That was my impassioned speech to you. What are some thoughts you have? Yes, Nero. All of them certainly add on to the finished work of the cross. They add works. Yes, good point. Oswald?
What was the church's response, or the denomination's response, when Mormonism was on the rise, or
Yeah, they criticized them. They just didn't have the nation's ears. But certainly the Presbyterians looked upon that as sad and ridiculous and dangerous. But at that point, the Presbyterians, they weren't prominent anymore. So kind of like today. Other thoughts or questions on these movements? Are you surprised to learn that they all came about the same time in the same area? Isn't that interesting? Not a lot from other countries. It seems like we start them and we spread them, unfortunately. Yes?
Yeah, I think part of that has to do with lack of structure, because America was just a very young country. Back in the day, in the early century, when they had someone come with a strange doctrine, they would have a council and quell it immediately. But since there was no such structure, I think it was free for all. So that's, I thought, why.
And what was the measurement at that time for success in religion? Numbers and response. What's going on today? Why do these celebrity pastors who have been convicted of abuse, why did they get away with it for so long? Why did people excuse them? Because what were the two reasons? Numbers and response. God must be using them. They're untouchable because it seems God's hand is on them. The same mentality, and look at all the damage from that mentality. Has anyone? Oh, go ahead.
You see a lot of, crazy stuff, like underwear and all now, but you see some of the evangelical churches using some of this. I know the church I used to belong to for years, they looked down on education and forced tithing they did, and there's more morality in the workspace. I don't know if they got it from that or they had it originally, but something appealing.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they got it from Mormonism, but there is some, right? Yes. Yeah, exactly. Has anyone had any experience trying to share your faith with a Mormon? Does anyone want to share that experience, the difficulty you've had with that?
I had two Mormons come on my prom night. I was literally on my way out.
I'm sure your date appreciated you stopping and witnessing. Yeah, a burning of the bosom, it's called. A testimony.
At some point in the conversation, one of them kind of like just grabbed the Book of Mormon and said, I swear to you, just pray tonight, the Holy Spirit will reveal to you. And I thought it was so dumb, so I did the same thing. I was like, I gotta do this. So I was like, can I borrow this? And I got his Bible, and I was like, look at me. And then I do the same thing.
Yes. Nick.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the question is here, but it's, when I think of Mormons, I do think of like these perfect families, and they're in it, these kids are great, and they just do everything really well. I'm just trying to think, why is that so? And why is our life sometimes more dysfunctional, it seems like?
Well, I will say this, that things on the surface aren't always what's underneath with Mormons. As I've gotten to know them, there's a lot of alcoholic problems in Mormonism. Utah has a very high alcoholic rate. More and more Mormons are getting divorced now that it's a little, you can get away with it. Wives are very subjected in Mormonism. So there is an appearance of everything together, but I wouldn't go by appearance. They have to keep that appearance up. But they do stress family unity, and that's everything. So they do have it at some point, but, you know, it's not for God, the true God, for sure. I'll tell you this, going back to what you guys are saying. We had in our church in California a former Jehovah Witness who was in it for about, he was an elder, and he became a Christian. And I asked him, what was it that finally turned it? He says, it was really all those years of going to Christian's door and having them challenge me, and I didn't have an answer. I would actually lay in bed at night thinking, I don't have an answer. And God used all those Christians, all those years, to push them to the point finally. So you may think when you discuss that, that they seem closed. You never know. Yes. Yeah. Oh yeah, Jehovah's Witness will flag your house, and they'll never come back again. So, go ahead and then.
I know Mormons and Jehovah's, their target audience is new Christians.
Right.
People that are just into the Christian faith, but they're open to anything.
That's right. I know that if Mormons come to my door, I'm sending them to Osbaldo's house. Because he will outmock them with whatever they do. I like his strategy. Now, here's a question. I don't see it anymore. Do Jehovah's Witnesses still go out on Saturdays? Because I have not seen them. All right. Not in my area. We walk on Saturdays. But they still do. Yes, Carl. And then Gloria. All right, Gloria first, and then Carl.
I was just a comment. I knew some Jehovah's Witnesses that were supposed to go out every day, at least in California. They were going out at least 1 or 2 hours every day.
Yeah.
Higher than their other books, but yet practicality don't. So I
I said, yeah, actually, I'd love to see that. So he showed me. It totally said nothing about anything about William Tyndale proving anything about their side of things. But it is interesting to see, you know, along the lines of what Baldo was saying, and using similar language, but trying to twist and you know, make it look like, hey, you have these important guys. Hey, they're actually agreeing with us, too. So
yeah.
We show you.
I'm sure they walked away scratching your name off their list of people to visit. Any other thoughts, Lena? Yeah, I mean, you can point out their silliness at times, but doing it respectfully, right? Any other thoughts, Stephanie? Yeah, they do get burned out, as the saying goes. Yeah, let's close in prayer. Our Father, thank you for this time. We do thank you as we consider these things for the sound doctrine you have given through your word to your church, and that in its essence it has been held to for thousands of years. Help us to hold to the same truths and help us to teach others who are being led astray. We pray in Christ's name, amen.